Let me tell you something, brother. I'm not here to be judged by you. Who needs to do some explaining is the Undertaker. I need to find out just which side he's on. What side of the river does he stand on? Which side of the fence does a man stand on? That's what I need to know.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is adjusted for the following World Wrestling Federation event.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 157 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, on the road to WrestleMania 8, I guess this would be, WWF Superstars from February 29th, 1992. I just wanted to do this one because, not because it's a road to WrestleMania show, and I like to do those during the actual time before WrestleMania in a given year. It's more for the leap day thing. You only get a chance once every 4 years. I've been doing this podcast since February of 2017, so I haven't had this opportunity. I don't know what I'm going to do in 2024 if this podcast is still going on. I guess I'll have to lean on somebody to get me the WCW Worldwide from this same day, but they also had a pay-per-view. I did actually watch that one, Super Brawl 2, over like 4 or 5 days in the last few weeks, and also checked out WrestleMania 8, which is not very hard to get me to do. I just sat down on a Saturday afternoon when it was 45 degrees out, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to watch this even though it's a seasonably warm day here in the northern suburbs of Boston for the middle of February. But before I get into everything else, let me get in my plug. You can email show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. You may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Do check out the other outstanding shows on Pro Wrestling Only. Now, I'd be remiss to return to my Twitter feed. I'm still going through all the, quote, show images that I've had in, well, it'll be now 157 episodes. I'm kind of skipping the specials, I think. There's really no need for it. And as I record this, I'm getting close to 100. So I think I'm going to get there before the month ends. But again, I'm going to have to start posting them in bulk, I think. Another thing is I'm kind of testing the limits of Twitter in terms of how long I can possibly make a thread. Now, I know that there are some people out there who really do long threads and then you can link them together using some app. But no, this is going to be like 160 tweets strung together with a bunch of photos. Because I was trying to organize my Google Photos and I don't know how many pictures there are in there. I'm just kind of bringing it up now. I think I saw there's about 7,600 pictures or something like that. And I swear that about 5,000 of them are wrestling related. It's like, I need to like whittle this down, like friends and family and then pictures of the warlord. Like how many, like seriously, if somebody like captured my phone, like why does this guy have so many pictures of muscle bears on his phone? But no, it's not what you think. I do a wrestling podcast and I need screen caps for them. And accordingly, because I do a wrestling podcast, sometimes I have to find strange places to watch these shows on a weekly basis. I know a couple of weeks ago, I knew I was going to have my car in for repairs, and it was going to be a couple of hours, so I watched a 96 episode of WWF Superstars while waiting for them to change the oil, you know, do whatever it was that they do for every 60,000-mile service at Hyundai. Well, in this case, on Saturday, I was getting all new tires, which is directly related to the last thing because I paid so much to have the 120,000-mile service, to have the brakes done and all that. It's like, well, I'm going to be keeping my car for a while, and I've had these tires on my car for over 60,000 miles, so why don't I just switch that out? And it reminded me that, well, number one, the last time I got tires, I went to the same place but a different location. It's always go to the location that you prefer. Like, if you have like two Wendy's in your town and one Wendy's is way better than the other, not to turn into Cornet here, always good to go to the good Wendy's because you'll just feel better about it. But the point that I want to make is, and I know not everybody could do this on, you know, the proper regular schedule, but the simple pleasures in life are what really make it worth living. And one of those things that I've found is having brand new tires on your car, because you can ride around town. And I'm not saying I'm walking, you know, driving around with a gangsta lean or anything like that, but it definitely felt good. It's much quieter, and you just get an inner calm with brand new tires. I almost want to set up a different trail as a podcast. A lot of them have Patreon, and you get extra content or whatever. I'm thinking you contribute to this show, and yeah, maybe you get to request a show or whatever, but you do a thing where enough money comes in, and it goes into a scholarship fund, and it gets rebated. Like, one lucky listener every 3 or 4 months will receive $100 off a set of four tires or something brought to you by Goodyear or Bridgestone or whatever. I believe it was actually Bridgestone tires that I ended up getting. It must be burned into my brain from the Bridgestone NHL Winter Classic sponsorship deal. You always think that that kind of advertising doesn't work, but it actually does. They're just playing kind of some kind of sick long game with you, and that's how they get you. It's weird that I would buy like name brand tires when I might only be planning to keep my car for another 25,000 miles, but I don't know. The difference was negligible between that and like some weird brand that I don't quite know the name of. I mean, if you're going to pay that much, you might as well just get the good brand and be happy with it and just drive your way home. I was thinking with Leap Day coming up, and you get this every 4 years, like, what kind of memories do you have from February 29th? Like, let's just say outside of Super Brawl 2 or the upcoming AEW pay-per-view that I would name, except for the fact that I watch AEW on mute when I do have it on. So I never remember the names of things on there. I just sort of watch it and I'm like, oh, okay, you know, when it happens to be on. Like, February 29th, if you have a birthday on that as, like, a celebrity, it's, like, instantly memorable. Lyndon Byers of the Boston Bruins and also the dearly departed rock station here in Boston, WAAF, which changed over to some sort of contemporary Christian uplift station over the weekend, which made me really, really sad because that was my station in high school. Dick Albert, Channel 5 weatherman for many years, since passed away, but he was born February 29th, 1940. I don't know. Like, what do I remember from February 29th's past? Well, when I was 13 years old, actually, I would have been 12, in 1992, I was suspended from my youth hockey game because I two-handed a kid across the back in, like, a scrimmage. So that, when I was saying that I got into a fight in my last game that I ever played in 96, I'm not joking. That is how I was. I was a complete prick and a total heel known throughout whatever league that I happened to be in. I pretty much was the goon, now that I think about it. Maybe that's why I identify with him so much. And also, February 29th, 2000, there was a Boston Bruins versus Ottawa Senators game wherein I arrived at the start of the third period at this game. Now, why would you show up, Pete, for a game at the start of the third period? Why don't you just skip it? It was because I had been to every game that year and I wanted to maintain my perfect attendance. The Bruins were trailing 4-0 at the time, and I was taking a sports journalism class at Boston University. And one of the things, I don't know if they still do it there, but it was a pretty ingenious thing of the professors where they would schedule stuff for weird times. When I took sports writing with Jack Falla, dearly departed Sports Illustrated writer of days gone by and one of the best professors I ever had, his classes were Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 8 a.m., to basically weed out anybody who's like, oh, I don't want to have any 8 a.m. classes. And I took it one semester, and I really enjoyed it. Sports, I figured it was like sports broadcasting or whatever, was at night on a Tuesday from like 5:30 to 8:30. So I wouldn't get out of there until close to 8:30, so I would make it to the then Fleet Center at 9 o'clock. It's 4-0 Ottawa when I get there. The Bruins score 3 straight goals after I show up, so I'm like this hero. And then Ottawa scores an empty goal and wins it 5-3. And that's pretty much it for February 29th. I mean, there's nothing else that I can even remember from that day. Like, February 29th, 2016, I don't remember anything other than if you work in mutual funds and you work in bond funds, it's kind of a weird accrual thing in February where you have A-furl instead of D-furl, which I would really go into, but I think I've talked enough nonsense on this podcast in the intro so far. So why don't I just get to the World Wrestling Federation for February 29th, 1992. I was very angry with the WWF. That's probably why I two-handed Nick Chuler across the back. By the way, I'm very sorry, Nick, that I did that, if you're listening. I know you're not. And it wasn't because I was mad at you for not catching my throws back to the pitcher in that Little League game in 1991 and allowing two runs to score. It was the one game I was ever a catcher. But no, I was just a very angry kid. And I was angry at the WWF because they, I've established this, they insulted my intelligence after the 1992 Royal Rumble by changing the commentary because they completely misread how Hulk Hogan helping Ric Flair eliminate Sid Justice was going to be read by the crowd. Sid Justice, a hero to those of us in the Northeast, kind of inexplicably to some, because here's this dude from West Memphis, Arkansas, but I absolutely loved him, along with a lot of other people. And it bothered me, because I did not want to boo Sid at all. And, like, they have him turn on Hogan, and I'm just kind of like, all right, I guess we're doing this. But Hogan's going away, and they don't really start promoting that until after this point in time. But they really start pushing in the ramp up to WrestleMania, especially that last special that they had on the USA Network, Road to WrestleMania. Like, thank you for Hulkamania. Freaking Vince, like, you're welcome, brother. I know the Laps fan has done a whole bit on that many, many times, but a lot of interesting things going on in the WWF, and a lot of it is covered on this show. So it's not just the whole leap year thing of why I would pick this. I mean, there's enough stuff here happening, enough of a hook, that if this was like March 8th, it's something that I would have considered doing. Because you have Jake the Snake Roberts on the funeral parlor, and he's going to be wrapping up at WrestleMania 8, but if you're watching this, you'd have absolutely no idea. You think, okay, Jake's been there now for 6 years, and you just assume that he's going to be there, I mean, for the foreseeable future, but the things are changing there. A lot of it had little to do with why Jake Roberts left, but he's got an issue now with The Undertaker and with Paul Bearer, so he's on the funeral parlor, going to try and hash that out. In the update segment, we have news of new WWF Tag Team Champions, which is interesting. The timing on it is rather interesting in terms of when those belts were won and when this show is. I'll go into that as we get into the show. And of course, we have our normal matches that we have. We don't have any feature bouts on there. February, ordinarily a sweeps month where you will have a name matchup. I mean, unless you're considering the Texas Tornado versus Kato from the Orient Express, the Tanaka-less Orient Express, because he's not there for whatever reason. You got Sergeant Slaughter and Hacksaw Jim Duggan as a team in action. And what is 1992 WWF without a Papa Shango match? I mean, jeez. And, of course, El Matador, Tito Santana, Papa Shango's a dark match opponent at WrestleMania 9, is in the opening contest as well. So, without any further ado, why don't I just get right to it for Leap Day, February 29th, 1992, WWF Superstars. So come on, baby, come on over, let me be the one to show you. In the time the American Top 40 has existed, it's always been done on a Saturday, and February 29th has only landed on that day two times, in 1992 and before that in 1964. Because the calendar works in 28-year cycles, except when you get to that weird leap where it's not a leap year at the start of a century. Like, 1900, I don't believe, has a leap year. So it's every 4 years. You know what? I'm kind of going down a rabbit hole. So the number one song is To Be With You by Mr. Big. You know, you might not have guessed that one. 1964, it's pretty easy. You know it's the Beatles, because they've come over to America to make the country feel better after Kennedy got assassinated. And yes, it's I Want to Hold Your Hand from that date. And you go back 28 years before that, 1936, I don't think there's, there is definitely no American Top 40 at that time. I am kind of surprised that the Superstars of Wrestling is listed in the title, because Vince is referring to it as just Superstars, so I was kind of surprised to actually see that written out in the graphic. Now, if you think the number one song from Leap Day in 92 is trivial, Vince McMahon is all ready to tell you what March of 1992 apparently is. You know how they have those bullshit things where it's National Pet Day on Twitter? Well, Vince, he was down with that for well before any of that stuff was around.
Coming to you just in time for National Frozen Foods Month. It's the Superstars of Wrestling.
Wait, he actually did say Superstars of Wrestling. I crossed myself up because I was looking at the banners as the show was going on. And you've noticed when they showed Superstars of Wrestling with the old logo, it would actually have to blur it out because of that whole lawsuit business. And I think the reason why 92 Superstars might be on the network is the banners don't say Superstars of Wrestling, so there's no need for them to blur it out. And for whatever reason, I just figured that I erred on the side of believing that Vince McMahon in the year 1992 wasn't going to say wrestling, and I was just sloppy in my notes. National Frozen Foods Month, is that really actually a thing? And to answer your question, the answer is yes, it definitely still exists. Via the NFRA, make sure to put in the F there, because that's a very different organization if you get the F out on that one. They're promoting on their website March Frozen Food Month, with consumer gift card giveaways, consumer communications through influencers. Oh, God, I'm rolling my eyes already. You know, frozen food was important to me at a particular point in time, mainly when I was eating Swanson dinners. The big ones. The beer-battered chicken and cheese fries were my favorite, but it's probably nothing I could eat now, considering that I have vowed to actually put thought into it. So, it's National Frozen Foods Month. Vince is setting Mr. Perfect up, because this is Vince McMahon and Mr. Perfect are our hosts. So, he's feeding Mr. Perfect for some puns. And I gotta say that Perfect, my critique of him, while he's okay in what he has to say here, he sometimes is a little too cute for his own good.
Well, speaking of the cold, McMahon, this week on the Funeral Parlor, Paul Bear's guest will be Jake Roberts. And after what happened last week involving Randy Savage, Jake Roberts, and The Undertaker, you've got to wonder, McMahon, will Jake be able to keep his cool? Will he be greeted by Paul Bear warmly, or will he be given an icy stare? I know, Jake, he wants revenge, and revenge is a dish that's best served cold. Some people say the Cold War is over, McMahon. I say it's just beginning.
I'll give Perfect credit. He kept it going for about 45 seconds. And Vince McMahon has some of the best facial reactions when guys say stuff, especially the heels and promos. It takes me back to a simpler time when it's 1981 and he's wearing the Crayola canary yellow jersey, you know, jacket, and he's rolling his eyes at what Blassie or the Grand Wizard has to say. But instead, it's 1992 and Mr. Perfect is there. The Cold War is not over. I just think of all these historians in, you know, the last 30 years who like just completely misfired on stuff, like Francis Fukuyama saying that the fall of the Soviet Union should be marked as the end of history. I mean, has a historian ever been more wrong on anything than that? Although I do remember there's a David Halberstam book that I read, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's a history of the United States in the 90s. And at the, near the end, in kind of the epilogue, he says, as the United States faces absolutely no threats to its security entering the 21st century. It literally came out, the book was released like the week before 9/11. And I remember that because I had just started working at Barnes & Noble a short time after that. So anyway, for our opening match, we have El Matador, Tito Santana, and he's taking on Brian Elmo. Oh, it's Elmore, not Elmo. Elmo loves to do jobs! Yeah, I got nothing for this match because I mean, it's El Matador, Tito Santana. Yeah, he became a bullfighter the previous fall because that's how long the training is. Apparently, just in a few vignettes, you can learn and master all the aspects of bullfighting. But they do set up the match with Shawn Michaels for WrestleMania 8, which you'd think it was going to be Shawn versus Marty Jannetty, but Marty Jannetty's off in his own world. He's got issues. So here in comes reliable Tito Santana to do the work that others should have been doing. And they actually kind of eliminated each other in the Royal Rumble, which is how you set that up. And we get a Shawn Michaels inset promo alongside Sherry, and I'm scratching my head at one of his comments.
WrestleMania 8. Millions and millions of people are going to see Shawn Michaels, the man of the 90s, do a Mexican hat dance around the head of El Matador. And Matador, you're going to find out what she already knows. Shawn Michaels is the sexiest man.
What are you trying to insinuate, Sean, with Mexican hat dance? I consider that a racist remark, and we should go out and try to cancel HBK for stuff like that. Racial remarks made 28 years ago, and perhaps get him fired from NXT so we can actually have normally booked main events that don't always have to go 29 minutes with 700 kickouts of finishers. God, I'm just on the wrong track here. As Howard Finkel reads off the show, the card for the upcoming Madison Square Garden show on March 23rd, which is a very interesting one. We're going to get promos for it a little bit later. It's, of course, not on the network because, God forbid, they post any house shows. I mean, El Matador, I mean, what the hell am I going to... You know what I should do? I haven't done this in like 2 years. I'm going to use another phone-a-friend because I got nothing on Tito at this point. I've spoken of him so much, not only in this podcast, but in other shows. So I'm going to call up Keithy, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, and see if he's got any takes on, I don't know, El Matador circa 1992. Hey, Keithy, it's Pete. You're on the podcast now. I'm out of Tito Santana takes, you know, El Matador era, early 1992. Do you have anything you could help me with? Any thoughts about the man in that particular era or whatever?
Yeah.
I mean, you got anything?
Well, I mean, I got several things if you want. I mean, do you want the real life or do you want how things ran in my Hasbro figure federation?
Oh, did you book Tito strongly?
I did, actually. I did book Tito strongly. I was always a big fan of most of the way that the figure was set up. I liked the design of the way that the Hasbro figure was, and I was really a big fan of his pants, and I really liked how he you could put the WCW Galoob title belts on his waist, and they fit very well. So Tito oftentimes was either a United States champion, Intercontinental champion, or tag team champion.
Oh, so it was definitely the mid to late 80s in your world.
In my world, it's always been the mid to late 80s, but he still came out to the music, and I believe I actually had the WWF cassette tape that had Tito Santana's theme music on it.
You did?
The one from the Matador.
Well, I mean, I guess we can just rip it off YouTube, but if this was the late 80s, early 90s, I would be very excited right now.
Yeah. Of course, but I mean, I would. I would sit in my basement with my little... you know, Galoob and Hasbro figures, and, you know, he was definitely not a main eventer. I mean, Tito was pretty much well represented of the undercard in my federation, and, you know, he would come in, and I would put the cassette tape on, and it would da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then Tito would come out to the, you know, local fanfare in the Malden region, and sure enough, he would always put on a very good Matt classic. I mean, I respected Tito Santana, you know, as a child, and I, even though at that point, by the time I was watching, he had definitely fell down to the mid card. But I still was a big Tito Santana fan, and I remember the vignettes for the Matador; those were awesome. Like with him just, you know, down in Mexico learning how to fight bull.
Would you agree though that he learned that a little too quickly? You think?
I think so. I mean, especially since they tried to hype up the fact that it was like something that took years and years of... It's very much like the Ace Ventura 2 when he's trying to win his Medal of Spiritual Oneness, and he goes, "This took you 80 years to achieve," and his sensei just gives it to him to get him out of the temple.
I've never heard that Tito Santana Ace Ventura 2 comparison, but it is rather apt. But I do have a question about the Hasbro figure, since I never actually thought of an El Mat. Is it an El Matador figure? And if so, have you ever made guacamole out of it?
No guacamole, but it definitely is an El Matador figure. I mean, It was actually, if I remember too, so when I where I grew up, I kind of grew up on, you know, next to a highway that a Toys R Us was off of. Uh-huh. And because I was, it was definitely not within walking distance, but I was so determined to go to that Toys R Us to get these Hasbro figures when they came out, because the back of the WWF magazine had all the new figures like Doink the Clown and the Earthquake and Typhoon and the new Undertaker. I was like, I need to get these. I actually walked over to the Toys R Us and got them probably like a mile and a half, but adjacent to a major highway, you know, where you had to walk by rotaries and, you know, dodge oncoming traffic that definitely were not looking out for a short, rotund little boy. And I walked over to the Toys R Us, and I remember picking up my El Matador, because I'm pretty sure the El Matador was the only one that they had left, because nobody was buying a Tito Santana El Matador figure in 1992.
So what you're saying is, it's kind of like, you know, since this show is early 1992, it's like that Proclaimer song from the time period, except you would walk 500 miles to buy an El Matador Hasbro figure.
Absolutely, 100%.
All right. Well, thank you, Keith. You came up huge for me here, and I hope that I may need more Tito Santana takes in the future, but you definitely got me through this one, so thanks a lot.
Oh, arriba!
Always a delight talking with Keithy, although I forgot to ask him if the Hasbro figure came with the little cape thing that El Matador would wave around before matches. I would assume not, because that's a lot to put in the little box. I don't even remember ever seeing an El Matador figure, and now I know why, because he went out and bought the only one that was available in the Boston area. They just couldn't sell, but he got it.
Update. An inside look from the pages of the World Wrestling Federation magazine.
Hi again, everyone. Update brought to you by the World Wrestling Federation merchandise catalog, where you can score big with the WWF Superstar Shootout Hockey Game.
Do I want that hockey shootout game? Absolutely. Thing is, though, I had one of those when I was a kid, not the WWF one, the NHL one, and for whatever reason, it had, the two teams were the Oilers and the Flyers. I guess maybe it was because they had met in the 85 or 87 Stanley Cup Finals, but yet, on the side of the rink, it had the logos of all the teams, and it had the Colorado Rockies logo, which wouldn't have been used after they moved to New Jersey in 1982, which is one of those things that's been kind of a mind screw with me for many years. Now, if you want to talk about scoring big, and just the word big, and we had Mr. Big earlier, you got Gene Okerlund with these glasses, with just these absolutely massive frames that kind of resemble ladies' glasses. It's like that Seinfeld where George bought ladies' frames.
He sold me ladies' glasses!
You just imagine that Gene went into the store and he couldn't see so well, and he didn't have anybody there with him, and he just picked out the wrong one, because they're just gigantic on him. They just look all wrong. I would rather him be just completely blind and without glasses. Maybe he couldn't wear maybe wore contacts and just couldn't at this. Who knows? All I'm going to do is speculate here, and there's really no point in any of that. So the flashback to a show in Denver, Colorado, and I talked about the timing in the intro. This Denver show happened on February 8th, so it's good 3 weeks, and now all of a sudden we're getting the news revealed on it. So, it has to do with new tag team champions. So, take it away, Gene.
Recently, the Legion of Doom were scheduled to defend their tag team titles against the Nashville Disasters. However, prior to that matchup, Jimmy Hart, the manager and spokesman for the Nashville Disasters, contacted WWF President Jack Tunney to inform him that one of the members of Legion of Doom had been injured in a previous match with the Nashville Disasters. He added that in the interest of fairness, perhaps Mr. Tunney should consider the Legion of Doom defending their titles against a different tag team. In this case, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and his partner, IRS.
Okay, we're not off to a good start here, because either Hawk or Animal is injured. Now the match has to change from the Natural Disasters to something else. It's a bit of a head-scratcher. Doesn't it make more sense, just from a storyline perspective, to say, oh, I don't know, Typhoon tripped over something in the hallway and he fell and he hit his elbow and he's got an infection, something like that. Why couldn't you just do that? Make up some bullcrap. Like, I know it's very hard because Typhoon is one of the most well-coordinated people in the history of professional wrestling. He wouldn't fall down and injure himself or anything like that. So, okay, maybe there's an explanation for all this.
Now, this request, according to Jimmy Hart, came with the full consent and support of the Nashville Disasters, who again, according to Hart, only wished to take on the Legion of Doom when LOD was once again at their full 100% capacity.
Now, I'm starting to smell a rat in all of this, because one half of the team in question is Earthquake, who killed a snake on television back only a few months before. I guess it would have been 10 months before this, but my memory is very good. But all of a sudden now he's so honorable that he does not want to face a possibly compromised opponent. Something doesn't seem right here, but of course there's more to the story.
President Tunney agreed, and the result is we have new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions in the Million Dollar Man and IRS. However, as this story unfolds, it now appears clear that Jimmy Hart took dirty money from the Million Dollar Man to maneuver, to manipulate the Natural Disasters out of their rightful number one contender's position. The whole thing, folks, was a setup, a sting, a scam, a con, if you will.
And that was the first time that the words scam and con were used in conjunction with professional wrestling. So Jack Tunney signed off on all of this, and Money Inc. wins the titles. And now it's starting to become clear, all right, now I might have figured out why you would say that one member of the Legion of Doom was injured, because they're going to go away for a little while before they inexplicably show up at WrestleMania 8 for that interview segment where we have to pretend like Paul Ellering is a big deal for 7 minutes. What a complete waste of time that was. I mean, not to get onto that, but why did WrestleMania all of a sudden turn into a challenge taping with a platform interview just plunked into the middle of it? So Money Inc. wins the tag team titles. Now, the ironic thing about this is that the actual match itself has never aired. And the reason why, well, it was always said that they promised the Legion of Doom that they wouldn't show them doing a job to Money Inc. But the real reason is, in the storyline at the time, it was the Natural Disasters who interfered and allowed Money Inc. to actually gain the victory in that match. But what I do like is this now goes back to the old trope of 87, 88, 89. It's been a little while since you could go back to this. But actually, with Ted DiBiase's character, you could explain anything that he does by just saying, oh, he just threw money at the problem. Or, in my mind, Ted's superior networking skills, where he goes from Virgil, oh, no problem, I'll bring Sherry into the fold. When Sherry wants to leave, he just lets her walk to Shawn Michaels. Why? Because of his superior networking skill, he has Jimmy Hart at the ready, and all of a sudden, he's a tag team champion. Which, by the way, his first title in the WWF, since he held the North American title back in 1979. Oh, you thought I was going to say Million Dollar Belt? That is not an officially sanctioned belt by the World Wrestling Federation, as we know. But yeah, calling it a con, geez, in wrestling? Why, I never. I'm just going to drop my monocle. So the Natural Disasters, what do? They got to dump Jimmy Hart because they did not consent to any of this. Seems like maybe tag teams should start taking on Jimmy Hart as their manager because he just seems to betray all of them, like, every single time. Like, does anybody read history books in the World Wrestling Federation during the Golden Era? Doesn't seem like they do. So Jack Tunney, in his infinite wisdom, because he's losing his fastball. He's starting to throw cut fastballs at this point because his four-seamer, he's just not blowing it by hitters anymore. He set up the Natural Disasters against Money Inc. for WrestleMania 8.
That's right. You're looking at the new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Money Incorporated.
Yeah. Tunney, who do you think you are telling IRS and the Million Dollar Man where and when we have to defend these titles?
And whom we have to defend them against at WrestleMania? The Natural Disasters, they're nothing but rule breakers, cheaters. They just as soon break your arm. We're athletes. We're champions. And we have the best wrestling manager in the World Wrestling Federation, Jimmy Hart. And he knows all the flaws of the Natural Disasters.
That's right. And they've got a lot of flaws. And I'll tell you, too. I know they got some flaws. I'm going to tell you.
I love DiBiase referring to the natural disasters as, quote, rule breakers. Like, what has Ted been reading a lot of Pro Wrestling Illustrated lately? Because that would be the name for the heel. Oh, they're nothing but a bunch of rule breakers. And Jimmy Hart, always with the scouting reports, just like against the Hart Foundation at SummerSlam 88 when he came to ringside with Demolition, with the understanding that he still owned the contracts of the Hart Foundation, so he had permission to be there. So yeah, he's always got like the scouting reports, but like I said last week, he's like a football coach. He has the game plan in place, but apparently he can't find the flaws in the natural disasters because I guess the scouting of his own teams might not be up to snuff. I mean, I think my scouting of the natural disasters is just keep Earthquake out of the ring, keep Typhoon in there. I mean, you kind of have a weak link there. One of them put Hulk Hogan out of action for a period of time and was one of his very best rivals during this golden era run. And then the other guy didn't even get a match on WrestleMania 7 and fell so far from being the Hulk Hogan friend that they didn't even let him turn on Hulk Hogan. It was just, oh, he took shots at Hogan in the Battle Royal on Saturday Night's Main Event in April of 91, and before that, I guess they had a row, as the Brits would say, at the 1991 Royal Rumble. So, I don't know, I'm kind of doing Jimmy's work for him. Maybe it's just that I want a spot in the first family after everything I went over, the benefits package last week. And speaking of packages, you got the Hoosier Dome, a very big building to fill for WrestleMania 8, and sadly, they did not fill it, and they didn't even really come close. They were still at this point in time, and this is very commonplace now, where they have, oh, all the travel packages for WrestleMania, and it goes before the actual on sale, if I remember correctly. Yes, travel packages to go to beautiful Indianapolis in April.
And by the way, this will be the last week that you can acquire top-to-bottom travel accommodations in one big package from TCA. The number to call toll-free, 1-800-622-0305. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be back later in the hour with the WrestleMania Report. For Update, I'm Gene Okerlund.
I'm just glad he said travel package like a normal human being instead of that weird package thing that he said at WrestleMania 4 with Brutus Beefcake while staring at his crotch, which made it even more uncomfortable. And I'm also glad to report that even though we are 5 weeks out from WrestleMania 8, we do get the WrestleMania report on the show as he runs down the card. And you know how much I love those from all the prior shows that I've been able to cover those.
I think I know what's going to happen at WrestleMania when DiBiase and IRS defend the championship for the first time against the natural disasters. I think we're going to have new tag team champions all over again.
Or you're just going to book a crappy finish where Money Inc. just grabs the title belts and walks away and gets away with a count-out loss and the title doesn't change hands. The other thing about it being 3 weeks between the title change and when it's actually acknowledged on TV is they needed time in order to establish DiBiase and IRS as a team on TV. They teamed up on one of the superstars right before this, but it was just kind of a one-off thing. But you wanted to let that air so it doesn't seem completely out of nowhere, like, oh, these two random guys won the tag team titles. But who knows, really? There also might have been house shows like, okay, we want to keep the natural disasters heels for a little bit. There could be varying different reasons. As you could hear, the wonderful theme of the Repo Man in the background as Vince was talking. He's taking on Don Richter. Poor guy, he's not even plugged at the top of the show as being on the program. He's not the only person with that distinction as he hits a clothesline right away. But, I mean, Repo Man's music, I don't want to say it was the best thing about him, but why does it amuse me so much? It's one of those Jimmy Hart songs where heavy on the synthesizer, you just got one lyric. It's very easy to remember. It's Repo Man. And it's just occasional through the song. I kind of like listening to it for whatever reason. It's also another one of those things where somebody made a custom Titantron for the Repo Man. Now, I have to admit, though, it is a little lazy because they just strung together about 25 seconds of footage and just looped it 6 times. Like, all right, that's not exactly the hardest work. Could you watch a few more Repo Man matches and show his entire arsenal of work, please? Which, in this match, included a back suplex because the former Crusher Khrushchev is letting All Japan know that if they want to bring him back in, he's now a specialist in collecting debts. You know, if there's somebody that Baba, you know, needs money collected from, he can go over there and do that job now too. But Repo Man is tied up in the World Wrestling Federation at the moment in a feud with Virgil, which, oh boy, I mean, 1992 Virgil, that's something special to be feuding with. But it's funny because they actually have more in common than they would have differences in. I mean, yeah, Repo Man did, you know, cost him the $1 million belt, and that's all fine because Virgil still carries it to, you know, the trade shows and all that stuff. But both dudes come to your house to demand money, seemingly, whereas one of them is there to repo your car or something you're behind payments on, and the other is there to basically, like, sign shit and ask for $20 in return. I live in fear that Virgil is going to come over and, like, sign, like, I don't know, the stone wall in front of my house and demand $20 in terms of payment.
Hey, Repo Man, I have to go way back now, man. I have to get just as sneaky as you are, man. Because where I come from the neighborhood, brother, you gotta be sneaky or you can't survive. I see the kind of man you are. You're just sneaking around, brother. Okay, now you sneak around and I'm sneak right back.
I'm telling you, if you really think about it, Repo Man and Virgil had a lot more in common, and perhaps they should have made one of those respect tag teams that they like to do, maybe more in the modern era, like with Sheamus and Cesaro. Look at how good that worked out. They had a best of seven series, I think it was, around 2015, and then all of a sudden, they're put together in a team, and bam, you got The Bar, one of the greatest tag teams in WWE history. Barry Darsow, has anybody ever had, like, a more diverse set of gimmicks in their history? Evil Russian, a repo man, an evil golfer who is evil for some reason, but not in, like, the Shooter McGavin sort of way, a sadomasochist, or whatever Smash from Demolition is. And you want to talk about that range challenge thing that's been going on Twitter, where you list, you know, person in four different photos. Barry Darsow's career, he would basically just beat anybody. By the way, he actually ends up winning this one with the leg lock, which is the Repo Man finisher. And he drags Richter around the ring, kind of by the neck, but Richter kind of ruins it by grabbing onto it with his hands to keep himself from being choked. Come on, you jobber. Look a little bit more helpless out there. I mean, we got to get the Repo Man over so that when he's done feuding with Virgil, they can team up and get a 4 or 5 year run with the belts.
And there's a look at the box of the Royal Rumble, courtesy of Coliseum Home Video. You remember well, I'm sure, the Royal Rumble, the fateful day when Ric Flair became World Wrestling Federation champion. Let's go back up to ringside.
So anyway, when I think back to the Coliseum Video days, I realized that I only actually owned one tape from that era, and it was the first wrestling tape I ever had, with the WrestleMania 4 Coliseum Video with the two VHS tapes, which inexplicably goes in the middle of the Andre Hogan match, where you have to actually change the tape on it. I'm sure there's a good reason for that, probably because it was the actual middle of the show. But I would always tape it off the live pay-per-view feed, and that's how I would have it. But, like, I never bought the WrestleMania 6 Coliseum Video, which, you know, maybe I should have, because I feel like I don't have the appreciation for that show that a lot of other people do who are my age, simply because I didn't get it on the original pay-per-view. I think I have a bias towards shows that I saw on pay-per-view. That's why I'm somewhat willing to defend Great American Bash 91, because I actually saw that. But in any event, we'll go to the next match, which is historic because it is the final teaming of this version of the New Foundation. Of course, Owen Hart and Jim Neidhart would reunite a couple of years down the line. They're taking on Todd Overbow, that's a weird name, and Chris Germany, also kind of a weird name. He used to be known as Chris Prussia, but then the family name eventually got changed. So yeah, this is the last call for Anvil and Owen. So what was going on with the Anvil around this time? I mean, of course, other than being the best friend that anybody could possibly have, as I explained in last week's Memphis episode, I couldn't find the exact reason why he got fired. It might have been an accumulation of all the stuff he nearly got fired for in the previous several years, like in 1990 and all the other various times where it seemed like the Anvil was on his way out and would always find his way in, even with a stint as an announcer on Wrestling Challenge, where he's the weird tacked-on third guy to the Bobby Heenan Gorilla Monsoon dynamic. Meanwhile, on commentary, because the new foundation, who knows when this was dubbed over, it's interesting that they're showing a match with a guy who's clearly out of the company because there's no Jim Neidhart matches after about February 15th. I think Philly Spectrum was the last time that he would be in a ring anywhere in the WWF, at least during this run. So Mr. Perfect, they have the chance to talk about other stuff. And here he reveals, I guess he might have alluded to it on the previous week's Superstars, a surprise for the Macho Man.
What is this alleged exciting surprise that you and Ric Flair have for the Macho Man?
You can't wait, can you, McMahon? You're probably starting to bite your nails over it. Don't worry. We got something on the Macho Man that you, not even you're going to believe, McMahon.
I don't believe it now, so chances are I won't believe it in the future, that's for sure.
Don't say I told you so again.
That, of course, is in reference to the pictures of Elizabeth alongside Ric Flair, which were later revealed to be doctored at this point. But it is kind of funny how 4 years later in WCW, Elizabeth betrays the Macho Man and joins up with Ric Flair at Super Brawl. So it kind of makes you think, all right, well, maybe those photos were real and you could retcon it back across promotions. And you know how much I love to do that. The Anvil is just doing his usual big man stuff, shoulder blocks. He holds up over Bo, and then Owen hits a elbow off the second rope, standing drop kick to the corner, and that allows over Bo to tag out to Germany. Owen actually drop kicked him to the other side, allowing the one enhancement tag, so Germany will be taking the pin in this one. Owen looks completely ridiculous with the new foundation getups. However, it is defensible in that Styles in 1992 were a little weird. I have to admit, like the whole skids, the Zubris, and all that stuff, very colorful things going on. So Owen, I can defend it on those grounds. It's when you get into the high energy and they're still wearing that, they've kind of fallen a little bit out of favor by that point. Owen does that move where he grabs the arm and kind of does the Northern Lights suplex, but doesn't like bridge into a pinning combination or anything. He would do that move for quite a long time. As Vince takes this opportunity to start taunting Mr. Perfect about how Owen Hart is a better looking wrestler than him overall, which is interesting because, you know, Mr. Perfect is not active at this point. But I also think back that, yes, those two guys had a WrestleMania match, and it was each their first WrestleMania. Owen as the Blue Blazer against Mr. Perfect at WrestleMania 5. A classic example of you kind of wish that they had gotten three or four more minutes to really get that match going, because I enjoyed it, but we could have done without Dino Bravo versus Ronnie Garvin and then the weird Jimmy Snuka introduction. As Owen flips up in the corner to escape a corner whip. He got whipped into the corner, walked the turnbuckles, and then did a backflip over. As tagged to Neidhart, they do a double shoulder block, an Irish whip, and a power slam by the Anvil. It sets up their finisher, the rocket launcher. Always a good finisher for any tag team, particularly one that has a power guy and a high-flying guy. It works every time. Maybe not to the level of the Midnight Express rocket launcher, which I guess there's no defined power guy from the Midnights, but it worked for them too. And that is how they pick up the three count and the final televised match, at least for this run, of the new foundation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is an election year. It is time for you folks here in the metropolitan area to cast your vote for more live World Wrestling Federation action. It's all taking place 3 weeks from this Monday evening, March 23rd, at Madison Square Garden.
As is often a perceived problem in American elections, the turnout was not that good for the election voting for more World Wrestling Federation action at Madison Square Garden, because that show on the 23rd of March only drew 9,000, and the main event is a pretty good one. Ric Flair and Sid Justice, former Four Horsemen stable mates, I guess, facing off against Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan. Now, if you had told the people that this, in fact, would be Roddy Piper's last appearance in Madison Square Garden for 2 years, and Hulk Hogan's last appearance in Madison Square Garden for 10 years, well, maybe more people would have come out, but clearly, 1992, the wrestling industry is starting to go into a recession. Kind of like, well, the United States had a little minor recession in late 91 that kind of got transferred into 92 in like the memory of the populace. That's how Pat Buchanan was able to challenge and get 37% of the vote against Bush in the primaries. The Democratic primaries in 92 were pretty crazy because you had a lot of different people winning. Like Tom Harkin won a couple of primaries, caucuses. Bob Kerry, the Nebraska senator. Of course, Bill Clinton eventually becomes the nominee. But Paul Tsongas won New Hampshire and Massachusetts and a couple of other primaries. So that thing was pretty wide open for a while. Not to mention the fact that Jerry Brown hung around forever, like in the middle of his career. Like that dude was governor of California in the 70s and in the 2010s. It's really kind of a head scratcher to me how that guy's career played out. But anyway, back to wrestling. That is a pretty cool main event, and I probably should sit down and watch that entire March of 92 MSG show, which would be the last show that they would film there for the MSG network for quite a while. There's that random one that they did in 1997 that is on the network. Unfortunately, this one isn't. Who knows why that is? All I know is if they take away live pay-per-views off the network, they sure as hell better start adding house shows on there, especially as they're ripping them off YouTube. So we get a promo with Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect are together, and Sid is there in the background. It just warms the cockles of my heart to see the much maligned 1990 Horsemen at least half reunited.
You call yourself a team? This is a team. This is a perfect team.
And we're the talk of the town. Look at it like this. Hulkster and you Hot Rod, this assures me of two things. I got the biggest and the baddest man in all the WWF on my side. And that means we got the power, we got the finesse, we got the brains, and Piper, there'll be no place to run and hide. And Hogan, look what's waiting for you.
Hey, you two idiots won't know why they say I am the man
that rules the world.
Woo!
On paper, I absolutely love this match, but until I really drill down and I wonder to myself, why is Sid not mad at Ric Flair also? Like, doesn't he want to become the WWF champion? Isn't that what he's aspiring to since he got robbed of it at the Royal Rumble? It kind of doesn't make sense to me. It's like, okay, just because they share a heel locker room means that now all of a sudden they're buddy-buddy and everything's cool? I don't quite get it, because wasn't that Sid's complaint that he should have been the number one contender? And when you think about it, Hulk Hogan gets named number one contender at that press conference, and fine, Sid gets pissed, he gives a speech, the most bogus act that Jack Tunney has ever pulled off. But then when they change the match, now the Macho Man gets the shot, because Hogan is pulled out, I guess, to only face Sid. That's the only reason why he would have pulled out of the Flair match. Just kind of strange to me that Sid would just go along and be friendly with the world champion when he has something that he desires. Now, on the other side, you have Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper. And it's so weird to think how this is the last time that they're going to be in MSG. It's basically the end of an era. And you think back to 1985 and their role in the first WrestleMania on opposite sides of the main event. Of course, they would team up in 86 when Piper has his face turned. But it's interesting here, at the end of that golden era, they're regularly teaming on house shows like this.
You know something, Sid Justice and Ric Flair, with the battle royals, the cowardly acts, all the backstabbing, and the twist of fate on your side, Flair, you're not even figured in after WrestleMania. We're going to make sure about that. But first, we're going to have fun in Madison Square Garden, right where Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan laid the groundwork for all this insanity. Mothers and dads, the Hulkamaniacs have. Brothers and sisters, they have. But now, Hulkamaniacs, we've got a big brother complex. Here. The big, mean brother that's going to watch our back. Get it, Flair?
You see, in the garden, what we got is a problem of bullies. We got Sid Justice, this big, huge idiot, Bumblecope. We got brain like this. We got idiot like this. We got a guy howls and screams, but really meows like a kitty cat. Tyson's gone. Buster Douglas is gone. You're looking for a few good fighters? Get set to sweat. You found him.
Hey, Roddy, it's James Buster Douglas. You can't just call him Buster because that has a negative connotation in the African-American community. I think the lesson of this show, and only drawing 9,000 and given that these guys wouldn't be back, is seize the opportunity to see things while you can. Like the chaotic wrestling show last Friday that I just completely zoned out and forgot because it was in Lowell and I didn't buy my tickets in advance, and I'm watching the Bruins play the Flames on TV that night, and I just completely forget. Oh, yeah, I need to travel 10 minutes down the street to watch Anthony Green face Alex Hammerstone, and I never made it there, and I kind of regret it.
Last night, Russ Beeler, owner of Lake Edna KFC, opened Hammer's eyes to new popcorn chicken. Delicious, crispy, bite-sized morsels. A whole new way to enjoy the Colonel's chicken. The problem was, no one could get him to go on. Until the last piece was gone.
Now that's pop.
New KFC popcorn chicken. Treat yourself for $1.99, the band just $5.99 in Lake Edna or your neck of the woods.
1992 was such a simpler time where popcorn chicken being a special at KFC was enough of a big deal. But back in those days, people didn't riot over chicken promotions at fast food restaurants. I still haven't had that Popeye's chicken sandwich, and it's across the street, Popeye's, from where I get my bagels every other Sunday. And I just don't really feel the need to go over and have it. I mean, yeah, I'm sure it's delicious and all, but a lot of chicken is delicious. That's why I eat a lot of chicken, like the Doors song. I eat more chicken than any man ever seen. Oh, wait a second. That has a completely different connotation. So anyway, up next, we got Papa Shango taking on Larry Williams. And he's got the smoking skull. Not Larry Williams, but Papa Shango. Maybe he just needs a belt for it so he could have the original smoking skull belt. But Papa Shango, he debuted on the February 8th Superstars, so he's still relatively new, which makes me wonder constantly, because I watched WrestleMania 8, and it's like I never had this thought before of, why do you have Papa Shango interfering in the main event of WrestleMania? It seems so insane to me, and maybe it's just with the benefit of hindsight. Maybe they thought, all right, if we paired this guy with the Ultimate Warrior who's going to do the run-in on the back half of this, maybe this will work. But I still don't get it, why you would insert him at that point in time. Like, you could have done the same angle on a Superstars. You could have had Warrior rescue Hogan just from Sid Justice or something like that. Who knows? And besides, I said on an earlier show, probably another WWF 92 show, because that's what Papa Shango represents. Voodoo is a babyface gimmick. I think it was Memphis that had Rastaman, and he was a babyface. But again, I cannot get my mind off the freaking WrestleMania. Like, why the hell was it so mistimed where Papa Shango is... It's not like he was 3 seconds late trying to get across and the referee had to stall. Like, he was 50, 60, 70 seconds or more late getting to the freaking ring. Like, how the hell do you screw that up so profoundly? And why is everybody so afraid to talk about it, who was in, like, a position of power? I mean, Papa Shango is interfering in the main event, the final match of WrestleMania. But he does have nice makeup, I will admit that. I can't have enough praise for the costuming of the World Wrestling Federation. By the way, with Larry Williams, just ignore his cage match, because it's one of those things where they combined a number of different dudes named Larry Williams, because I'm looking at this guy, I'm like, yeah, this is not the guy who worked in 1964 in wherever the hell it was, and there's always like these 10-year gaps between when another Larry Williams comes along or not. Now, Mr. Perfect, while he claims to be perfect, and I would presume that would mean all areas, like, Mr. Perfect knows where to get the best weed. Like, he absolutely knows everything. But apparently, he ain't perfect when it comes to religions, particularly voodoo.
I've never seen anything like this before, McMahon. You know, I don't know too much about voodoo, or what he represents, even. Somehow that doesn't surprise me. Do you?
Actually, no, it's, I don't know all that much about voodoo, but, I don't really care to know. It's one of those things that, more that you don't know about it, probably the better off you are.
You know, I was going to slam Vince for basically saying that ignorance is bliss in this case, but then I thought about it more deeply, and that voodoo, the way he's putting it, can also apply to the inner workings of the professional wrestling business. Because think about when you were a kid and you just enjoyed this on a really innocent level without reading Dave Meltzer or anybody else, any, you know, quote unquote influencers, I guess is the term that's used now. Didn't you enjoy it a lot more than you kind of do now? I mean, just in a more simple sort of way. So yes, voodoo, kind of like professional wrestling. So what is voodoo? I mean, obviously, I have to give at least a little history of it. I mean, do I know offhand? No. I mean, just that it's portrayed in a real comic sense in movies and TV. Just thinking of Pedro Serrano in Major League, which would have been 3 years before this. A lot of voodoo comes from Haiti and Africa and the West Indies. But I didn't notice that SD Jones had nothing to do with voodoo. This website has a long write-up on it with some pretty bad punctuation. It almost feels like a run-on sentence at times, so maybe Dave Meltzer did write this. Voodoo originated in the West Indies country of Haiti during the French colonial period and is still widely practiced in Haiti today. The foundations of voodoo are the tribal religions of West Africa, brought to Haiti by slaves in the 17th century. They were mainly captured from the Kingdom of Dahomey, which occupied parts of today's Togo, Benin, and Nigeria. The word voodoo derives from the word vodou in the Fon language of Dahomey, which means spirit, god. Haiti was isolated during much of its history, therefore allowing voodoo to develop with its own unique traditions, beliefs, and gods. And it goes on with, you know, how Haitian slaves were brought over, and, you know, you can read about that on your own. But, you know, kind of an interesting history there. Haiti, a little bit isolated for being a country that actually shares an island with the Dominican Republic, but the political situation in that country has never been particularly good. In fact, when I was looking up events that took place on February 29th, Aristide was officially removed from power on February 29th. Now, I can't remember which one it was. It's just that I remember that it was on February 29th. Shango's offense is very similar to that of the Godfather. Of course, it's the same guy. Charged the corner, slam, big elbow, but with less theatrics, I think, than even what the Godfather had. As Vince McMahon wonders if Papa Shango is going to WrestleMania. Well, geez, Vince, you know, how are we supposed to know if there's no sign up next to the Superstars banner for Shango to point at and challenge, I don't know, Tatanka to a match at WrestleMania 8? Gets Williams up in the backbreaker, body vice, and it's not the submission he's going for, it is the kind of inverted shoulder breaker that he does, and that is how he picks up the victory. And to Vince McMahon's credit, after saying he wanted to be ignorant about voodoo, by the end of the match, he's completely come around and says he wants to study up on it. So I could just imagine him, Bruce, and Patterson out by the pool reading books on voodoo. Somehow, I just don't think that happened.
And there you see, ladies and gentlemen, entertainment that's out of this world indeed. Out on video now, Suburban Commando. Starring, of course, the Hulkster.
You would have thought that the movie Suburban Commando would have entered my life at some point, and I would have seen it even by accident, but it's not like it's a staple on cable and that, oh, I'll come across it on TBS or any other station. And I've had like one of those New Year, it's not even really a New Year's resolution, but I find myself watching more movies since the start of this year, almost like a retroactive one. But I've been on a real sequel kick. American Pie 2, Austin Powers 2, Naked Gun 2.5. Watched that one recently. I saw that Goon. There's actually Goon 2 that came out in 2016. I'm kind of afraid to actually see that one. But of course, this last weekend, I noticed that the movie Stripes was on Netflix. So I watched that, and I like that movie quite a bit, but I think part of it might be kind of like thinking of like the cast as a Survivor Series team. It's like, oh, it's Bill Murray teamed up with John Candy, and you don't really get to see that all that often. So it was a fun movie. Maybe not the greatest ending in the world. It kind of feels a little bit tacked on, but it's okay by me. As we go to the Event Center, Sean Mooney for the Madison Square Garden show again on March 23rd. And one of the matches on that is a six-man with Bret Hart and the Bushwhackers against the Mountie and the Nasty Boys, because the Mountie and Bret had their history with the Intercontinental title in January. And yes, this is the famous match where Bret Hart is gif-ified or jif-ified, depending on your perspective, marching around the ring, bushwhackers style, during it. Kind of a fun thing for Brett. You know, he's going to be getting back the IC title. And this in-between period is interesting because you got this match at MSG, and it was either the end of January or the February one where he had a match with The Undertaker. It must have been the end of January one because Undertaker is wrapping up his heel run. And we actually hear from the Bounty and the Nasty Boys. And, you know, the Nasty Boys being from the Allentown area, they're kind of like the house tag team of this program. And you know I love me some Mounty.
Tell him, Jimmy! Yeah. Tell him! Mounty Nasty Boys, tell him! Oh, you're in a lot of trouble, Bret Hart! You're in a lot of trouble, Bushwhacker!
That's right, Bushwhackers, Bret Hart, it's as clear as day! You're on our ladder on the way up! The Nasty Boys and the Mounty are stepping over you like little bushwhacking nobodies! You're going through Nastyville on the way!
I like it! I could see, Bret Hart, that you made some new friends since I beat you for that Intercontinental title!
Listen up! There ain't gonna be any friends, Bushwhackers and Bret Hart! There ain't no Yayin and Warren and Nasty Bell! We're coming to fight, baby! You better bring everything you got, cause you're gonna get nasty-sized!
The Nasty Boys had a pretty standard stump speech promo that they would do, but Jacques Rougeau as the Bounty was always kind of funny in various different ways. Like, with the way his face would look, he would just make me laugh on a consistent basis. So on the other side, we got Bret Hart and the Bushwhackers, and I had to figure that at least one of the Bushwhackers, if not both, must have worked Stampede at some point in time. And sure enough, in 79, Luke Williams, before he was a Bushwhacker, he actually was under a different name at that point. He was actually known as Sweet William. Of course, he had a full head of hair at that point. But these guys together just strike me as kind of an odd combination. But it is a nice way to allow Bret Hart to have a little fun before things start to get serious again.
Whoa! What do I have to do? Yay! Get my hands on the Mountie. Now I got a six-man tag, and the Mountie, you're going to try to hide behind the Nasty Boys. It's not going to work. You may have shocked me, and you may have took my World Wrestling Federation Intercontinental belt, but you are going to pay for it in the six-man tag. I got the Bushwhackers, and they're going to take complete care of the Nasty Boys. And Mountie, I'm going to have you all to myself. Right,
boys? Oh, yeah! Captain Lucas is so exciting! That's right. Not only have we got the headman who's the greatest wrestler in the world, but boy, he ain't too bad looking either!
That's right, Captain Boy!
Let's beat the Hard Workers! Yeah!
I am definitely going to need to post a clip of this with the Twitter thread for this show, because Bret Hart, the smile on his face when they say that he's good looking, he's just so humorous. He almost looks like a cartoon character for whatever reason. It's like a smile, but he does not show any teeth. It's one of those type things. But don't forget, Brett's also got some unfinished business with the Nasty Boys, too. Because, I guess, on both sides are three guys who defeated him for the last two titles that he's held. Mountie with the Intercontinental title, of course, but the Nasty Boys beat the Hart Foundation at WrestleMania 7, and then Brett moves right out of a tag team, so he didn't have a chance to get proper revenge on Knobs and Sags, and I guess this was his big chance.
Certainly everyone wanting to be a part of the record-breaking attendance at the Hoosier Dome of over 72,000 strong. Hey, Mr. Perfect, do you remember when Steve Allen was in the shower singing with the Bolsheviks?
Yeah, I remember WrestleMania 2 when Tommy Lasorda was a guest announcer.
And how about Vanna White as the guest timekeeper?
And how about WrestleMania 7, the blindfold match when Martel versus Jake the Snake Roberts?
That was most unusual. You'll see the unusual, you'll see the outlandish, you'll see it all at WrestleMania 8.
Just kind of the quick reminiscing of celebrities at WrestleMania's past. Of course, there's only seven of them in the rearview mirror at that point. Now, today, they're reduced to getting celebrities like Colin Jost and Michael Che, which, oh, wait, I better not say anything bad about Michael Che, or else he'll harass me online for the next 3 years, because that seems to be his whole MO. So, who are the top five? I'm going to sound like the guy from High Fidelity, the Jack Black character. Top five celebrities from the first seven WrestleManias. Number five, I'm going to do a tie because the football players were kind of one entity, but Refrigerator Perry and Bill Frelick. Refrigerator Perry for the spot with Big John Studd in the Battle Royal and him pulling him out. I mean, I pop for that. It doesn't take much to really get me. But Bill Frelick, people forget, that guy got wrestling. And he's a smart dude and probably didn't need to play football. In fact, he had one of those weird contracts that paid him long after he retired. I believe he passed away a couple of years ago. He also turns up at the Yokozuna Body Slam Challenge a couple of years later as well. Number four, I got Mary Hart from WrestleMania 3. She was very good calling that match with the Hart Foundation and Danny Davis, letting us know she's not related to Jimmy Hart. Number three, another female celebrity who announced at WrestleMania, Elvira. I loved her calling that main event. I know I've said this many times where she's like screaming with Bundy bleeding. It's not even like a five-alarm Mexico-style blade job. It's like a trickle of blood. She's like, ah, why can't somebody stop this? And Jesse, the stern dad, it can't be stopped. Plus, Elvira's got tits to beat the band. Steve Allen at WrestleMania 6 is number two. The song in the shower with the Bolsheviks just inspired comedy. No more Stalin. I mean, come on. The wordplay just speaks to my very soul. And number one, of course, is the legend, the icon, the greatest of all time, will never be topped WrestleMania celebrity. I'm talking, of course, about Bob Uecker. WrestleMania 3 and 4. Maybe things fell off a little bit at WrestleMania 4. But then again, he did a lot of great interviews at that one as well. But I just enjoy Bob Uecker, both as a WrestleMania celebrity and as a baseball announcer. They go right into the WrestleMania 8 report. I mean, this stuff just really scratches me where I itch. As Gene Okerlund and his massive glasses are letting us know that a lot of the card has been put together for WrestleMania 8. Not all the matches, but we have all the major ones. And as a show, the top three matches of this WrestleMania are pretty damn good, even if it sort of lacks the panache of some of the, you know, the Mania Dome shows before this. Sky Dome, that's an easy sellout. Pontiac Silverdome, who knows what the actual number of attendance was. Maybe the ghost of Zane Bresloff will visit me in my sleep or something and give me the actual number. But those were pretty much sellouts, whereas the Hoosier Dome really had trouble moving the tickets. I mean, here they're still pushing the travel packages like earlier in the show. So our main event, or the world title match, one half of the double main event, Ric Flair defending against the Macho Man Randy Savage, a real accident putting that match together when Vince decided, you know what, we don't want to do Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair, which I understand from the perspective of, what were you going to do for your finish to that match? Were you going to do... You were not going to have Ric Flair beating Hulk Hogan clean. You weren't even going to have Ric Flair beating Hulk Hogan, you know, via cheating. And you weren't going to have Hogan beat Flair because he's going away for a while. But of course, you could have just done the DQ, the same DQ finish that you did for Hogan Sid. However, Hogan Sid, it seems like a natural enough matchup that I'm willing to allow it, because out of it we were able to get this brilliant match between Flair and Savage, with Mr. Perfect on the outside running interference and just cheating like crazy on behalf of Ric Flair, doing more than an executive consultant would probably be expected to do. And we get to hear from both Ric Flair and the Macho Man Randy Savage, and we're going to start with the champ, who, of course, has his executive consultant by his side. I just love now that I have business cards that say consultant. I just want to become an executive consultant someday, although I guess I could just call myself that. But I do dress a little bit better than Mr. Perfect, who is in his finest 1991 model year windbreaker as he delivers this.
Macho Man Randy Savage, WrestleMania 8. You're going after the big one. The World Wrestling Federation champion, Ric Flair. Well, we know something about you, champ. We going to the big show, Randy. You're the Macho Man, former WWF champion. Focused on WrestleMania 8. Focused on beating Ric Flair.
for the World Wrestling Federation Championship. But my friend, we have a surprise for you. A surprise that will take the whole world by storm. A surprise that will unfocus you. A surprise that will bring victory to Ric Flair and Mr. Perfect at WrestleMania 8. Woo!
They're still not at the stage where they're going to let us in on what that surprise is. That's not for another week or two down the road where, okay, we got a naked picture where you can see Liz's cooch or something to that effect. It's always the mind games with Ric Flair in 1992. You got this angle at WrestleMania, and then at SummerSlam, the whole Warrior and Savage match where he's running interference saying that one of them is, you know, joined up with us or whatever it was. But he's basically playing mind games with both guys. So interesting kind of carryover between shows. Now, on the other hand, Savage, he's by himself here. He does not have Elizabeth with him for this promo to just kind of stare at him awkwardly. They get divorced in 1992, as many people know. That does not take place until September. It's kind of sad to think about, so I'll just put that aside.
WrestleMania 8, ooh, yeah! Indiana Hoosier Dome. The World Wrestling Federation Championship belt up for grabs. Ric Flair, you are the champion, yeah. And you say you got a surprise. Well, I don't like surprises. Don't even like you, yeah. Your ego's bigger than mine. I'm telling you right now that at the Hoosier Dome, you're going to understand the fact. To be the man, you got to beat the man. And that's what I'm planning on doing. 1, 2, 3 in the middle of the ring. And once again, be crowned the World Wrestling Federation champion. You understand that, Ric Flair? I'm coming after you, yeah. Bobby the Brain Heenan and Mr. Perfect, who's not perfect. You can be on the outside of the ring along with 72,000 other people and zillions of millions of people all around the world. A new champion, Ric Flair, the Macho Man. Dig it.
If you throw a different wrestler out there and he says the exact same words that Savage did, I don't know, let me just pick somebody. Bam Bam Bigelow. Yeah, he's got a certain intensity and yeah, he has charisma, but the way Savage delivers these promos just makes him so far above anyone else. Like he could read the dictionary and it would definitely hold my attention. He could take like a basic message, like if you just read the transcript of what he said, and he just makes it into something great. So on to the other half of the double main event. Sid Justice against Hulk Hogan. Sid, of course, turned on Hulk Hogan on the Saturday Night's Main Event in February of 1992. 3 weeks before this, I covered that back in episode 39, Mike Crockett. Crockett wonders how I remember what the episode numbers are. Well, in going through that Twitter thing, that was one way to help me to remember what episode was which. But it was episode 39 in the archives. I covered that Saturday Night's Main Event and how Sid is a man of the world, but above all, was extremely pissed off about the Royal Rumble. And this match, as it turns out, at WrestleMania 8, I know I complained about the Papa Shango run. Why did it have to be Papa Shango? I'm sorry. I have to keep going back to like the main event of WrestleMania. Yeah, we need to have this voodoo guy that we haven't really established yet run in on the match. It's just so strange. But nobody likes that match. Everybody hates it. Meltzer probably gave it -3 stars. I actually like that match. Now, I'm a Sid honk, I guess you might call me. But the story of the match, now, I don't want to compare it to Flair Steamboat here, but I'm going to compare it to Flair Steamboat, Hulk Hogan and Sid Justice, because Hogan has no answers for Sid in the same way that Flair and Barry Windham had no answers for Ricky Steamboat in that tag match in January of 89. And Sid was very protected in that bout. And I'm not talking about him kicking out of the leg drop. Just the way he was presented. Like, the second the match ends, he's beating the hell out of Hogan. So Sid, he's going to get some promo time. And thankfully, Harvey Whippleman is not alongside. And this almost makes up for the fact I was really hoping that there was going to be a Sid squash match. One of those ones where he takes the jobber on the stretcher and throws him into the ring post. God, I absolutely love those. But Sid, with his promos in this period, from the heel turn to WrestleMania, oh, I love him so much.
Okay, Hogan. I'm going to try to make this as clear as I can, even where you can understand this. In all sports, there's always the hero, right?
or that hero always has to take a fall. Even in the jungles of Africa, the great lion himself one day gets too old. And then the young lion walks up and he takes advantage of the situation and he moves in for the kill. Well, you are looking at the new lion. You are looking at the new man on the block. You are looking at the man that will end Hulkamania. You, Hulk Hogan, are looking at the man that rules the world.
Feel my dick. I am rock hard for you right now, mister. You think I'm kidding? Feel it.
God, that promo was so great because it captures everything so perfectly. The older lion, and now he's the young one. He's going to come along and he's going to bump off Hogan, who gets to say his piece here. And something just seems a little off with Hogan at this point in time.
You Hulkamaniacs, I've seen the look before. I've seen the look before. When I saw Sid Justice at the press conference, when I saw the look in his eyes, I knew I saw it before. That's why I looked at the tape over and over. And finally it came to me. In the middle of the night, I realized that cold stare, the cold blood that runs through his veins, is the same stare I've seen in the Dahmers of the world, or the Mansons of the world, brother. My God, you've seen what he's done already around the WWF. Who knows, between now and WrestleMania, what he's going to get away from. But we've got to stop the thing, man. Hulkamania, in its truest form, is the only way we can stop this maniac, this madman. That's why, brother, when you step into the world of Hulkamania, you're going to find out that the four commandments that we've lived by through thick and thin will take your eyes first. The third one will take your breath. And the fourth one will take your soul, brother. What you going to do when my brand of justice passes sentence on you?
I'll tell you what seems a little off is at the beginning he refers to his fans not as Hulkamaniacs, but just maniacs. So I don't know what's going on. Does he have to cut a check to Marvel or whatever if he says Hulka? From now on, does he have to cut a check to General Hulka from Stripes? I'm sorry, that's really on the mind. Then he goes into referencing serial killers with Dahmer and Manson. Like, it's really dark places for Hulk Hogan, like, that you wouldn't see until the dark side of Hulkamania in 1995. But Hulk Hogan, at this period in 1992, he knows that he's going out the door, and it's almost like the last gasp. I mean, think of the run that he has had. From 84 to 92. It's like the last gasp of a great sports team that's had a run over a number of years. Think of the 2004 Los Angeles Lakers, who, you know, Kobe and Shaq, their last year together, and they had Gary Payton and Karl Malone as well. But they end up losing the finals to the Pistons, who in five games, who kind of steamrolled them because they were just a better put together team. 2007 Yankees, the last Joe Torre season as manager. They lose in the division series to Cleveland in four games and just never, they never really had it that year. And then they have to go through a what counts as a rebuilding year for them in 2008 before they signed a bunch of free agents to reload for 09. Do I dare say the 2019 New England Patriots losing three out of their last four games? Who knows? Only time will tell. 1984 New York Islanders won 16 consecutive playoff series en route to the previous four Stanley Cups. They make it to the Cup Finals again in 84, and they get run out by the Edmonton Oilers in five games. It's just kind of the last gasp of a dynasty. And that's what Hulk Hogan is here in 1992. It's been one hell of a run for the previous 7-8 years at this point. Comes in at the very tail end of 83 for those St. Louis tapings. So over 8 years. But all things come to an end. And eventually you're going to get diminishing returns from it. And it just so happened to coincide with a dip in the wrestling business. And Hulk Hogan, you can say a lot of things about him, but he was also smart enough to know to get out at this point because he hangs around through 92, business continues to decline. He's still got the heat on him from the steroid thing. That's not going to be good for the business of Hulk Hogan going forward. So I'll give him credit for getting out while the getting's good. And then you got your third match for the Intercontinental title, Roddy Piper versus Bret Hart. We do not get promos from either one of those guys, but interesting doing the babyface versus babyface matchup. And in watching it, which Bret Hart doing a far less ostentatious blade job than Ric Flair did later in the evening. Flair was so freaking obvious with that blade. It was like watching Buddy Wolf against Muhammad Ali back in 76. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go to your YouTube and type in Buddy Wolf, Muhammad Ali, and watch Buddy Wolf cut himself on camera on the ABC television network for like 20 consecutive seconds as Ali is just jabbing him to death. And I was waiting for Piper to just hit Bret with the belt and getting a heel Roddy Piper. I remember sitting there watching it live thinking that that was going to happen. But also a terrific match as well. Money Inc. versus the Natural Disasters has now been set for WrestleMania 8 at that point in time. In my rewatch of it the other day, I slept through that debacle of a match because if the champions are just going to walk out, it really just doesn't deserve my attention. And the final match that is decided for WrestleMania 8 at this point in time, February 29th, some 5 weeks before the show, is Tito Santana, El Matador, taking on Shawn Michaels, which just so happened to be the opener. Now, maybe it's just my inherent anti-Shawn bias, but I think Tito should have gone over here. It should have gone, I think, about 90 seconds. They could have had his sister, Ariba McIntyre, in his corner. And then Tito could go on and run NXT today, and we could have normal main events that don't have kickouts of every freaking finisher. And also, a side benefit, having that match, instead of going like the 9-10 minutes that it went, having it go 90 seconds allows more time for that Papa Shango running, and maybe they can get it correct.
We're back for more World Wrestling Federation action, and I must say, the bust that we saw, reminiscent, obviously, the first time we saw it was at the WrestleMania press conference in Indianapolis, of which you were a part. Did you have an opportunity to ride the bus, Mr. Burton?
No, I never ride the bus, McMahon. And one thing I want to know is...
That's a nice bus.
That's a bus. Oh, nice bus. Why? Because it's got Hulk Hogan's picture on the side? That should have had Ric Flair's picture on the side. He's the World Wrestling Federation champion.
Well, actually, I think someone was saying his likeness is on the bus.
Oh, yeah?
It's underneath the bus. You can't see it real well. It's down around the axle and the transmission and stuff like
that. Yeah, McMahon, pretty soon it'll be picking you off the windshield, all right?
I hope not. That's some bus, all right. And there you see some competitor, the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich.
It's so sad how much of an afterthought the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, is by this point, but there's a very good reason for it, and in fact, I was shocked that this match actually aired on TV, not for anything that happened in it, because it's over in 39 seconds, a tornado punch finishes. He gets a decent reaction because, you know, this is in Texas, and it's where the show is taped. But on February the 8th, so 3 weeks before this, it says Kerry Von Erich was arrested for attempting to forge painkiller prescriptions. And says the next day, Kerry Von Erich, while suspended, was arrested in Richardson, Texas, and charged with two felony counts of prescription fraud. Days later, police learned Von Erich gave them a false address and phone number following his arrest. Kerry reportedly entered a drug rehab program the following week. Now, how did that end up occurring? Well, I'm going to turn... I don't do this very often, where I'll turn to the Wrestling Observer newsletter, but... The WWF is saying that Kerry Von Erich will be welcomed back to the company when he completes rehab. Fritz Von Erich appeared on local TV in Dallas, where apparently it was a big-ass deal, and said that Kerry had been addicted to painkillers for 6 years, ever since the motorcycle accident that cost him his foot. Kerry's arrest was indeed for falsifying prescriptions for Valium and Vicodin. He's facing 10 years in prison and a $5,000 fine, but he will likely get a suspended sentence if he completes rehab. So that's where he goes. And yes, they actually bring him back in after WrestleMania, and he's there through much of the summer. I mean, he's working Kamala, so it almost feels full circle going back to World Class 1983. It's such a sad story with him. And I talked about Kerry on the Place to Be podcast on Monday that I did with JT Rosero and Scott Criscolo, talking the July 1990 Saturday Night's Main Event, because that is where Kerry makes his debut. And the comparison that I made was, it's like signing a baseball player that who's just well past their prime. The comparison I used was Albert Pujols, one of the greatest hitters of the modern era in baseball. And I was thinking how like the Los Angeles Angels signed him for the 2012 season when he was on the other side of 30. I take it a step further. It's almost like signing Albert Pujols in the year 2015 or 2016, where he's shockingly close to a replacement level first baseman. And Kerry, unfortunately, seemed to be more troubled than he was worth. But it's funny to think how, if Hulk Hogan is an entity, and it's funny, you know, having just talked about him and the run that he had, you rewind to 1983-84, if Vince McMahon could have gotten Kerry Von Erich, he might have actually gone with him. There's a debate to be made with Hogan and Kerry. I mean, obviously, I think the correct choice, because Hogan was better equipped to handle all the rigors of the road and all of that. And the other Hogan-Kerry comparison that I'm going to make, and I know I said earlier that I need to watch the movie Suburban Commando. Like, how haven't I seen that? On the other side of things, the Viceland documentary on the Von Erichs. I need to carve out some time and sit down and watch that. Of course, just like Suburban Commando, I will probably walk away from both of those experiences viewing a very depressed individual.
And there are, speaking of looking good, on the cover of the current edition of the WBF magazine, the Zouk Troy Zuccolato on the inside, the ultimate fat loss diet.
Don't be looking at me, McMahon.
Hey, what page is that on? Let me see that.
And speaking of fat loss, here's Paul Bearer in what would turn out to be the final edition of the Funeral Parlor, which started up right after WrestleMania 7 the previous year. I know I've given the history of the Funeral Parlor, and I've given my whole spiel about how it had a pretty high batting average just because of the amount of time that it was on and the number of hits that it had. And maybe it's that I've covered a lot of them on the podcast, so perhaps I have some sort of bias. The first big thing being the Ultimate Warrior getting locked in the casket for 3 minutes and 46 seconds, which I painstakingly covered in detail back in episode 12. You got Ric Flair confronting Hulk Hogan on camera for the first time in the November 16th, 91 Funeral Parlor. Roddy Piper spitting on the NWA title. I think that was August of 91, around SummerSlam time. I wasn't so crazy about the visual on that, considering, you know, what it represented. But it was something that you certainly remember going forward. And it only makes sense that I cover this because, well, it's on Leap Day, and it's the final Funeral Parlor, as I said. And I did cover a Jake Roberts Funeral Parlor from September of 91 when he was just getting that heel run going, where he is just so awesome at this point that it's kind of a shame that everything kind of flakes out and he's out the door. But when you really think about it, there's so many other people who left in the either at WrestleMania 8 or in the shadow of it that, you know, it kind of makes sense that he would end up leaving as well. Jake comes out to the sounds of trust me, and that instrumental theme that he had at the time. And I had never really given much thought to the similarities between his old theme and his new theme. A lot of people think his old theme from 88 to 91 is the best theme ever. Just, it is a pretty cool instrumental. But I never really considered the fact that this Trust Me one is, they just strip out one part of it. I forget what instrument they strip out of it, and they slow it down. Like, they slow down the track, so it sounds very different. Kind of like how I said the whole Jimmy Hart Al Pacino speech in my real voice last week, and I sped it up to make me sound more like Jimmy Hart, in case you were wondering what kind of audio tricks I was using for that. So Jake is out there. He's got no snake with him, because after the cobra bite, that was a bridge too far, and he couldn't bring that out anymore. And besides, for whatever PETA organization or the Humane Society would have been absolutely up his ass at that point, especially since the cobra ended up dying after biting Randy Savage. So for the benefit of the viewing audience at home, who may not have been following this over the many months, this alliance of Jake in The Undertaker, because this goes all the way back to August now, so we're talking 6 months here. So you got to review the history for anybody who might have jumped in.
I'd like to talk just a moment about your history, with the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Everybody around the world remembers SummerSlam, the reception when the lovely Elizabeth was opening up her presents. And then there was the time that you had the Macho Man tied up in the ropes, your giant King Cobra with his venomous fangs sunk deep in his arms, and you, Mr. Roberts, were laughing and shaking the snake. And then there was Tuesday in Texas. Oh, yes, Miss Elizabeth was prostrate over her husband, crying, begging for you to leave her alone. But no, Mr. Roberts, you put your hands on her lovely face. And then, just last week, Mr. Roberts, after your match with the Macho Man, you were lurking behind the curtain like a buzzard on a fence post with a steel chair ready to send Elizabeth to meet her maker.
Shut up!
I think Jake was right to stop him, because that covered just about everything except for the thing that I uncovered when I did that primetime wrestling from August of 91 that also was the Macho Man's bachelor party. It was that he left Jake Roberts off the invite list, or Bobby Heenan did, or whatever, and Jake was holding that against the Macho Man. So that established the motive for why he would have hassled the wedding reception. So, and that's something that was always kind of a plot hole in all of this. But yeah, something that was just a little thing on prime time that lasted 2 or 3 minutes. But I guess we're just going to leave that out of it, because it doesn't seem like they've established that as canon. We just want to accept that he just put a snake in a box in order to amuse himself, basically. So all the clips, the greatest hits, the wedding reception. We don't get to see Sid saving the day with the steel chair, though, because he's now a heel. He's now sharing a locker room with Jake. The snake bite and Tuesday in Texas, where he's slapping Elizabeth around. You know, some pretty bad stuff, even for, you know, the cartoonish world of professional wrestling. But now the tide is turning a little bit, because The Undertaker kept Jake from hitting Savage and Liz with a chair as they were coming back through the curtain after the Saturday night's main event match, which is interesting in terms of the live audience. Now, I don't know what kind of tricks they used for this, but the day before in Lubbock was the Wrestling Challenge taping. That was also where they taped the Saturday night's main event. So now they're here in Amarillo the next day. They kind of run down everything that happened. It's not necessarily going to be the same crowd. There's a hell of a lot of space between Lubbock and Amarillo. I don't think that's something where a lot of the people who are hardcore fans may have necessarily gone to both shows. So there's probably some tricks done. Who knows if maybe they dubbed in audio or whatever. But what I can tell you is, and this is a thing that you do as a dark segment in order to encourage the crowd to cheer or boo certain things, try to steer things in a certain direction. In an unaired segment on this taping, Mr. Perfect came out and insulted The Undertaker, who came out and, you know, I guess, threw Mr. Perfect around, or probably didn't throw him around since he had the Lloyds of London thing, but maybe just sort of chased him out of there. And that would basically signal to the crowd that, yeah, you could feel free to cheer The Undertaker now all throughout this taping.
Let me tell you something, brother. I'm not here to be judged by you. Who needs to do some explaining is The Undertaker. I need to find out just which side he's on. What side of the river does he stand on? Which side of the fence does a man stand on? That's what I need to know.
Well, why don't you just ask him yourself?
Whose side is he on?
As he would sometimes do, The Undertaker comes out of one of the coffins on the set. Now, when Ric Flair was confronting Hulk Hogan in November of 91, he came out of the one on the left side, which was behind Hulk Hogan. This time, he came out of the one on the right side. I don't know how he decides which one he's going to hide out in. I don't know if it's like a lefty-righty matchup in baseball where he studies the platoon splits and I should be in the righty coffin. Is he a switch coffiner? I don't entirely know. So, okay, these two guys who had this weird alliance of evil that I think probably had Kevin Sullivan masturbating to it somewhere, because this seemed like something very much up Kevin Sullivan's alley, and it's all taking place in the WWF, and he's just nowhere near that. So, okay, maybe these two friends can hash this out, right?
You and I have a real problem. Now, I'm standing here, and you need to tell me something face to face. Just who in the hell do you think you are, and whose side are you on? You tell me, whose side are you on? Come on, tell me whose side you're on. Face to face, come on. Make up your mind, man. You make it up. Not yours.
I don't know what else he could have said in answering that question. Like, what sides are there? It's not like it's a one or the other. I guess he'd be on Randy Savage's side. But it's best to be safe, to err on the side of caution like The Undertaker did, and just say, yeah, I'm just not on your side. I don't know which other... It's kind of like if you're switching political parties, like, oh, you left the Libertarian Party? Well, which one did you go to? Well, not yours. It's something along those lines. Of course, The Undertaker's political donation history is very much public, but I don't really want to go into that right now. So Jake, he understands what gives The Undertaker his power, so he goes and reaches for the urn, and that's only going to escalate the tensions here.
Wait a minute.
Is this what makes you tick? Is this what you need in life? Is this your cross that you have to have, brother? There it is, man. Let me tell you something, though, big boy. I owe you one. Don't turn your back on me. I owe you one.
Oh, wait a minute. No. Look what he did.
You loved it. What did
his
you
hand,
do?
His hand is caught in the end of that coffin.
What did you do?
The Undertaker trying to get his hand out of the casket. It's sealed shut. It's tight. It can't be moved.
They've got to be smashing his fingers, McMahon, flat. They've got to be smashing them flat.
Now, while the main attention should be to The Undertaker's hand being trapped in the casket, like it's basically shut down on his fingers, that DDT that Jake gave Paul Bearer, holy crap, did Paul Bearer ever go for the ride? It's one of my favorite DDTs that Jake ever delivered anywhere. And he references it in when they show the video of it in his WrestleMania 8 pre-match promo, which doesn't get the same love, obviously, as the WrestleMania 6, you know, wallowing in avarice, and Longfellow couldn't have said it better himself, and a lot of the other Jake promos as well. But they show that DDT, and Jake says, short ride, bad landing. Oh, I absolutely just love that phrase. He just has this ability with his delivery, kind of similar to what I was saying with the Macho Man earlier on. So Undertaker only has one hand trapped, so he could still do stuff with the other one, but you figure it's really got to hurt. So Jake just kind of wails on him with a chair three times, but then grabs the microphone because he's still got more to say, and because it's Jake Roberts' heel 1992, I'm always willing to hear him out.
So now, as you can see...
Wait a minute, he's back up. He's back up on his feet. The Undertaker is standing tall.
Okay, you want to play for a little bit, huh, big man, huh? I like to play too.
Jake Roberts at the table, the chair. The casket now.
The full weight of that casket, McMahon, on his hand.
Roberts working to the rib area. Once again, the Undertaker is spent. I can't believe what has happened. I can't believe what Jake has done.
Before I was so rudely interrupted, I was about to say, as you can see.
Wait a minute. He's standing up again.
You're some kind of freak, huh? Yeah, you're a real freak, boy. Come on. I got something left.
Look at this. The Undertaker is back on his feet. He's trying to drag the casket. He's trying to get his hands on Jake the Snake Roberts. Undertaker is coming for him.
I've never seen anything like this, McMahon. He's dragging that casket. It's got to weigh a couple hundred pounds at least.
I was going to call BS on Mr. Perfect saying that the casket weighs a couple hundred pounds and Undertaker dragging it around. But in fact, caskets can weigh anywhere from 200 to 400 pounds or even a little bit more than that, depending on the quality of it. I mean, that looks like kind of your normal casket, so let's put it at that 300-pound mark. Again, I'm not trying to be Gorilla Monsoon, you know, in the Department of Weights and Measures here, but just your standard casket would weigh somewhere in that ballpark. And The Undertaker is dragging it around as he's kind of zombieing after Jake, who doesn't know quite how to handle it, which is strange considering they've been hanging out for the better part of 6 months. But Vince being like, I can't believe Jake would do that. Like, oh, you can't believe that he would shut a casket on a man's hand when he literally had a cobra bite a man in the f***ing arm on television in the ring in front of everybody. Just seems to me that there's a significant difference between the two acts we're talking about here, that Vince can't believe that he would do something that's more akin to a college prank than having a freaking cobra. It's like, next thing you know, Vince is going to be like, yeah, Jeffrey Epstein trafficked teenage girls and had them in sex slavery, but can you believe that he likes pineapple pizza? Not to, you know, make that a podcast topic, because I know that there are other podcasts who are talking about pizza and what constitutes real pizza, and I don't really want to open that can of worms right now. So The Undertaker, if you can actually hear kids chanting for him as well, so the buy-in was very much immediate for the audience. Don't forget, this was taped a month ago, so a little bit of lead time on this one. But Jake, he is not done, because he's kind of backtracking, because he's hitting this guy with a chair, and he just kind of keeps zombieing after him.
Jake Roberts is thinking about getting out of town.
I got to interrupt real quick, because Vince had absolutely no idea how true that statement would come to be, with Jake holding him up for money at WrestleMania 8 and then leaving immediately after. Because apparently Jake turned up backstage at a WCW show around this time prior to WrestleMania 8. Now, it doesn't seem that weird when you consider that his dad worked for WCW at the time. But then you think, well, don't they have, like, not the best relationship? But what was he doing there in the first place? I know, I'm reading into that comment. He means he wants to get away from The Undertaker. It's just funny to think of the alternate meaning of that.
Look at this, moving back in. Look! Nothing can stop The Undertaker. The Undertaker slowly but surely continuing to stalk Jake the Snake Roberts, dragging the casket in his left hand. Oh, look at that.
That's it. Take a knee out.
Roberts can't believe The Undertaker is again standing tall. And yes, dragging the casket slowly.
Is there no stopping this guy, McMahon?
Jake Roberts moving back in on The Undertaker. A chair can't... Oh, my. Nothing is going to stop The Undertaker. Nothing.
nothing is going to stop him. If Jake Roberts knows what's good for him, he'll get out of this arena, and he'll get out of this arena fast. Nothing is stopping The Undertaker. He's still stalking him.
That's some good stuff to set up the WrestleMania 8 match with Jake and The Undertaker. Very early on in the streak, it's only the second match, and people are not thinking about that at all. And you don't consider him versus Jake when you think, oh, well, what are the great Undertaker matches at WrestleMania? Well, that match kind of went to serve to make him as a babyface because he just completely destroyed Jake, even after taking two DDTs, tombstones him on the floor, and ends up beating him in 3.5 minutes. It was pretty fun to watch in retrospect, because I always forget just how much, well, Jake hitting the DDT twice is really, really startling, because that was an extremely protected move in the WWF up to that point. And then all of a sudden he's hitting two of them on this guy who just shakes it off and then hits his finisher on the floor, which still in the golden era kind of meant certain death. So a fitting way to close out the funeral parlor with stuff happening. Yes, the first big angle was Ultimate Warrior being trapped in a casket. And now at the end, well, Undertaker is trapped in a casket, sort of. I mean, it's just the tips of his fingers. Just the tip.
What a tag team combination they make. Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah, I'll give it to you, McMahon. They're working pretty good as a team right in here.
Because of the way the funeral parlor played out, you have to put it more towards the back end of the show, because it just kind of casts a shadow over everything that would come after it. I know sometimes the funeral parlor would be as early as the second segment, depending on what was going to be there. But we get Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Sergeant Slaughter up next against Dale Wolfe and Rudy Gonzalez. And there's not a whole lot going on here. Supposedly, I've seen that perhaps Sergeant Slaughter and Jim Duggan were going to be the original opponents for Money Inc. at WrestleMania 8. I mean, Duggan and DiBiase, putting them on opposite sides of any matchup, I think is okay by me. But then again, you could take anybody who was feuding between the years 1984 and 1986 and put them opposite sides in a match in like 1990, 91 or whatever, and I'm okay with it, just to kind of keep that, like, the life of that feud going, whether it be Midnight's Rock and Rolls, Tito and Greg Valentine, or DiBiase and Duggan going all the way back to Mid-South, as Duggan and Slaughter hit a double backdrop, and at this point I realized there hasn't been a single back elbow on this show. I am absolutely floored by it, unless I missed it. But no Irish whip and back elbow. This was done on to Dale Wolfe, who tags in Gonzalez, who then gets backdropped. They quickly hit their finisher. It's Slaughter, an Irish whip into the three-point stance running clothesline by Hacksaw Jim Duggan. And once again, I have to note that it's funny how Sergeant Slaughter got rehabilitated so friggin' quickly. So I'll just quickly pitch my idea to book Sergeant Slaughter, which would have been he randomly helps baby faces in the fall and nobody is trusting him yet. And it just takes time after time of him helping them out. And then eventually, you know, after 4 or 5 times, he helps Duggan and he gives him a hug. But then again, maybe that's spending too much capital on it and it would take too long. Because it's not like Sergeant Slaughter was going to be an active wrestler for that much longer. So I guess maybe what they did was okay, considering that it was going to be just for a short period.
It may not exactly be your patriotic duty, but it is the American way. Join the World Wrestling Federation 3 weeks from this Monday night, March 23rd, when it all starts at 7:30 p.m. at Madison Square Garden. Shawn Michaels will go one-on-one with Virgil.
What a dream matchup that is. Virgil, Shawn Michaels, Madison Square Garden, New York City, the home office of the World Wrestling Federation for so many years. I mean, this is the match that people definitely wanted to see. Now, what I wonder, though, and we get to hear from Virgil, thankfully, because I'd rather hear from him than Shawn Michaels, because, you know, he might say something original or funny. Why is Virgil's little logo behind him? Like, the V in Virgil looks like a check mark made in a box. Like, it's really weird looking.
Hey, Lovebird. Lovebird. I'm talking to you, Shawn Michaels. You're a great lover now. I see now you got Sherry. She fell totally in love with you. Well, that makes you nothing, man, but a loser, because she was definitely a loser, okay? She was with Ted DiBiase. He took her and shipped her off. She came right to you. Where's she gonna lead you? That's right. She led you right to me, and I'm gonna take care of you, brother. I'm gonna straighten you up the right way. I'm gonna hit you right in your mouth. No more kisses.
Wow, Virgil's pretty fired up. He sounds like a Marine outside a bar in Syracuse in 1995.
Virgil determined to give Shawn Michaels an attitude adjustment March 23rd.
Wow, Virgil's going to give him a Death Valley driver, too? The guy is so prolific. He's inventing moves, like, years in advance before they would be used by others. Maybe we should, you know, turn our attention to him and appreciate him a bit more, being the wrestling superstar that he is. Now, Virgil's buddy, Tito Santana El Matador, on the same show, he's taking on IRS. Unfortunately, we get to hear from the tax man.
El Matador, I've had the opportunity to look into your personal life, and I don't like what I see at all, Tito Santana. You're a man that doesn't pay his taxes. And to Erwin R. Scheister, there is no man lower on earth. But it's time that you paid your fair share, Tito Santana. El Matador, it's time you quit hiding behind that.
I was so bored in the 15 or 20 seconds or whatever the hell it was when IRS was talking that I was pondering an alternate reality, probably because he's talking about Tito Santana and taxes, where Tito rips somebody off. And I'm thinking, maybe to do this story right, I know it would be an adaptation, but you bring in Tito's best friend to the WWF, who of course would be Virgil, and you do a shot-for-shot remake of The Shawshank Redemption, starring Tito Santana as Andy Dufresne, Virgil as Red. I don't know who would be that young guy who comes in and gets killed in the middle of the movie. You know, that disturbing part that I don't really know. And, of course, the sisters. I don't know who that would be. Maybe that Terry Garvin stuff, stuff was going on. You could definitely make a Shawshank remake, or I guess it would have been the original Shawshank, since that doesn't come out for another couple of years. So yes, that is what I want most in the world. 1992 Tito Santana and 1992 Virgil collaborating on the Shawshank Redemption. That would be wonderful. And I should just think more about casting that movie with all those guys. Promotional consideration, because this is early 1992. Hulk Hogan vitamins.
Hey, you little dudes, train, say your prayers, need your vitamins.
Hulk Hogan vitamins!
Yay! Hulk Hogan vitamins, the new champion of children's chewables.
I've never been a huge supplements guy, particularly as a child. Like, I didn't want to get, like, the Flintstone vitamins or any of that stuff. What I was getting for a brief period in my life was I would travel to this bizarre shed in Melrose, Massachusetts, where I would buy zinc supplements. I don't know what the hell I was thinking then. I just remember that there was a weird period where it would turn my poo green. I don't know if the zinc had anything to do with that, but supposedly it helps in guarding against colds. It will not help against guarding against Cole, as he's still in NXT, despite the fact that he has olive oil arms. They tell us next week on Superstars is a Sid squash match, and I hit my forehead like so, because damn it, I wanted to have a Sid squash match on this show, but, you know, this is pretty loaded. We're almost at 2 hours, so I guess that's a wrap for WWF Superstars for February 29th, 1992. And just going to do the quick podcast plugs. Be sure to check out the Sportscasters podcast with my good pal Steve Bennett. And we do have a new Adams Division podcast that will be coming out next week. It will be dropping on March 3rd on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, looking at the first 14 WrestleManias, developing a card of 10 matches where you cannot reuse wrestlers, titles, or use more than one match from any given WrestleMania. So a lot of rules that I put in for this concept. On the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, looking at Pro Wrestling USA show from October of 1984. It's a couple of weeks after the show that I covered back in episode 105 with Angry Bob Backlund. I think he's probably on there doing a promo as well. And then, sadly, episode 200. And I say sadly because, yes, indeed, it is apparently the final wrestling podcast about nothing. And I'm just sad that I didn't get to make a bumper music thing for Mike Crockett, Brian Malonis, and Brian Fury that I wanted to. It basically would have just been the Mike and the Mad Dog WFAN bumper. Instead, it would have just, you know, been WPAN instead of WFAN. I guess it wasn't all that original when you really think about it. I do not have a show thought up for next week, but, you know, I'll come up with something. I mean, hell, I've released something every Thursday or Friday for the last 3 years. So, I don't know. I'm kind of poking around. I did find some new channels on YouTube that are kind of hidden out there in plain sight that has some older world class shows and a few other things that I certainly would like to get to. So do check that out on social media. I'll probably post what show it'll be at GF Allentown Pod in due time. And leave a 5-star review on Apple Music, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever the hell it's called, and wherever fine reviews are accepted, because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. And I love you, person who left that 5-star review that actually used the term social proof in your review. God bless you. Thank you so much for listening. And tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.